Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Now, it is not every weekend that we would start the show with an ornithologist, but then Sean Ronayne is not just any ornithologist. Good morning, Sean.
Hi, Brendan. How are you?
You're very welcome. So, Sean, you've written a memoir, Nature Boy, and it's about your life, and you've had a wild and a fascinating trip in life, but it's also a kind of about your mission to reconnect us all to nature, I think. I think the mission might be paused a bit in the next few days, might it? Your first child is due.
Yeah. So we have a little girl due any day now. Hopefully not when I'm in the middle of a radio show, but... Yeah.
Okay. How imminent are we talking? Just so I can have a plan B if you need to run.
Any day now, I'd say. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Sean, loads of people watch your beautiful documentary, Birdsong. So you are now famous as the guy who records Birdsong and has turned us all on to this amazing thing that's all around us that we don't hear. I believe the minute your daughter is born... her name's going to be Leia?
Laya. Okay. Me and Alva had a joke about this because I said it sounds a bit like Leia Health Insurance. So it's Laya. It's a Catalan name, L-A-I-A.
Okay. Yeah. And the minute Laya is born, you're going to drop, as they say these days, a new Birdsong album.
That's right, yeah. That's right. So the album is called Hope. And this hope, I guess it's symbolic in a number of ways. So the hope refers to my hope for a nature-filled future for my daughter. And for everyone, and for nature itself. So the first track it's actually a composition, and again it nods to her dual heritage. So my partner Alba is Catalan, she's from Barcelona. So half of the tracks on this album are recorded in the wild spaces of Catalonia, the wonderful wild spaces of the Pyrenees and the steppe and the forest there. And the other half are recorded in our last gems of wild spaces, gems that we can expand upon and that we need to cherish and love and protect. So the first track, actually, it's a composition. So with Laya's heartbeat, I got some strange looks recording that in one of the last scans in Cork. And then there's a tolling church bell in the Catalan Pyrenees and then an explosion of birdsong.
So this what a beautiful thing to do for your first daughter's birth. That's something that she will have all her life. I can even see it there when you start talking about nature, and people will remember it from the documentary as well. The joy and otherworldly feeling that comes on your face when you talk about birdsong, particularly when you hear birdsong, what does it do to you? What's that feeling?
You know what? I was just speaking about it to Alva there. I might not show, but I tend to get very nervous before things like this, you know, radio shows and having a camera in front of me. And Alva tells me that, you know, Sean, don't worry about it because... you transform, you become a different person. You know, you're almost unrecognizable because I am a very shy person. When it comes to people, if I'm not talking about birds, that is. But when I listen to bird sound and I talk about bird sound, like I forget about everything else. This is my world. You know, this place lives in my head constantly. I dream about it. I live it. I absolutely love it. And for me to get out there and listen to bird song and to be in those wild spaces, I can't describe how happy and calm it makes me feel. And to be able to share that with people and to see that glint in other people's eyes, it has been, you know, even more amazing for me. Yeah.
Your dad and your grandfather kind of brought you out in nature from a young age. I think you kind of needed that to balance out school, did you? Because... No, you wouldn't get your autism diagnosis till you were in your 30s. We'll come back to that. But the signs were probably there. You struggled in school, did you?
Well, you know, I did and I didn't. So academically, I was grand. Like I did well because I've always been very structured. And you know, I'm very prone to routine. So, you know, when it came to school, failure wasn't an option for me. But with my classmates, I guess, I knew I was different and they knew I was different too. So like all of my friends followed whatever the cool trend was. Back then, a lot of people would cut their hair really short and they'd have certain clothes, you know, Nike runners or whatever. But I had a big mop of hair and I remember like a bottle green pair of Doc Martens. So this is where the nickname Nature Boy came from, because on top of that, like I was always like wandering. My mind was wandering and I was looking out the window watching blackbirds picking worms in the lawn and whatever was flying past. But my grandfather and my father both saw that in me, and my mother too, I must say. So my father was more of the outdoors person. He brought me out there and nourished that side of things. And my mum really encouraged me, and she bought me all the latest books and would entertain me and listen to my really nerdy stories. But it started very young with me. I was out, and they used to bring me out in the pram to Kuskinny Nature Reserve in Cove, because I was really hyper and I was always crying and agitated. And it's because I, even back then, I needed to be out there. So my dad would bring me down there, and he quickly learned that when he started to point out the different things to me, that I was silent, I was calm, and I was watching, and I was soaking everything up, even at that age. And he would imitate the sounds of different birds and animals. And when it came to the point where I could actually speak, I was answering him, and I was saying, swan, frog, and I was, you know, so
yeah.
I guess it was always meant to happen, but I'm very lucky.
Yeah, but you were so lucky, because, like, your life could have probably been very different if first your parents, your grandfather recognised that in you and put you on that path. And
yeah.
It strikes me reading the book, there are these pivotal moments in your life, good and bad ones, mm-hmm. but that kind of put you on a path. So,
yeah, for sure.
Like, even the first time you took a drink, right?
Yeah.
2006, you were 18, yeah. You're in UCC.
Yeah.
You kind of overdid it.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
You thought it was your first hangover. Tell me what happened.
Yeah. God, yeah. So I went to UCC young. So I was 17 for all of my first year. And, you know, when you're young at that age, you want to party and you want to go out. And I couldn't, because obviously I was underage. And
geez, that never stopped most people.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. But, like, I turned 18 on the 20th of April, and it was kind of smack bang in, you know, getting up to study month. So I stayed focused, and I kind of let my hair down, maybe, as you say, a bit too much, went out, and I got up the next morning, and I felt very bad, and I went back down to Cove, and I assumed that, you know, this is obviously a hangover, but it progressed, you know, it got worse and worse and worse and worse, to the point where when I was standing up, I was collapsing, you know, and I was finding myself unconscious on the ground, picking myself up. You know, I knocked my teeth out, I burst my lips. It was not pretty. And my parents, obviously, I was living with my parents still, so they obviously copped onto it and realised something was seriously wrong. And they started to stay with me, and I became delirious. So they called a doctor up. It was an out of hours service, and they came up, and they thought, see, some of my symptoms were masked, so they thought I had gastroenteritis, and it just, like, even when the doctor was there, I thought she was my aunt, and I was congratulating her on becoming a doctor, you know. Mm. My mind was gone, like, you know, it was getting really bad. And when I said that, my parents started to realize, like, something is serious here. And then I was passing out and coming back, and then I asked my parents if we had been in a car crash and if everyone was okay. And sure, I didn't even drive. I didn't have a theory test, you know. But anyway, look, it got very bad, and a doctor came at first thing in the morning. And I remember I was very lucid. It was strange. I was very aware. Well, I had moments of clarity, I suppose, and I could see his hands shaking. And he went white, like, you know. There was a look of panic came over him, and he went outside, and, like, he was dropping vials and the papers were going everywhere. He was in a state of panic, I suppose. Yeah. And he called a taxi to bring me down, fluids and a drip and things, and to get things moving, because he knew the time was of the essence.
So you had was it septicemia?
Yeah, so that's why I was passing out. I had septicemia as a result of this form of meningitis. It turns out it was meningitis type Y, which I think is a rather rare strain in Ireland. I think it originates in Asia.
So you nearly died?
Oh, I mean, nearly is the word. Like, very, very, very close. Like, all of my family, my close family members were called in to say goodbye, and a social worker was brought in to prepare them for my death in a room outside. And I was in and out, and I had another moment of clarity, and my hearing is very good, like, extremely good. And I could hear them kind of whispering, and my mom was saying, like, you know, to my brother, like, to wipe your tears, that you can't let him see you crying. You need to be strong for him. And that's when my mom kind of let the mask slip, like, because they didn't want me to be aware of this, but I kind of was. And my mom said to me, like, Sean, look, you're too young to die. Please fight it and don't give up. I knew it then, like, and I was falling asleep. I say that, you know, put inverted commas. I was that was me dying, like, you know. But I was very, very lucky in that Professor Mary Horgan had come in on her day off, and she had been upstairs working on my bloods. And she saved me at the very last minute. Like, everything was failing. The septicemia was coursing through my body. All my organs were shutting down. And this is why I was passing out. My heart was barely beating. And yeah, so they got me at the last minute. Very, very, very lucky to come out of it. Yeah.
And came out of it in a way, you would say, reborn, different person.
Totally, yeah. I mean, I think about this every day of my life. You know, and it's a long time now. And like, back then I was very inwards. I've always kind of struggled with socializing in my own way. And I said to myself then, like, God, Sean, you nearly died. What are you afraid of? You know, you need to grab life by the horns and just give it everything, because tomorrow might not come, you know. That was a reality to me now. It wasn't something that you see on telly. It happened to me.
Yeah.
And so I decided there and then that I was just going to give everything my all. And ornithology was my passion. And I knew that this was exactly where I wanted to go, and I was going to pour my heart into it.
Okay. So then another kind of pivotal moment then that I think completely changed your life. You were working in ornithology for a while, but you came back to Cork, and you were working in the Old Oak, which is a well-known pub in Cork.
Yeah.
And and you met Alba.
Yeah.
Everything changed. She had to make the moves initially, I think, did she?
She did, yeah. And there's one of my favourite parts of writing the book, I was laughing so much recalling the stories. God, Alba basically took our relationship by the hand. Like, but there was a brilliant woman by the name of Alison that worked there. She's a gas character, real salt of the earth, Cork City character. And she knew that I kind of struggled with people. And she said, Sean, I'm going to set you up with a lovely lady one of these days. And I would say to her, okay, Alison, yeah. And I thought she was joking. And then one morning she came down and she's like, Sean, I'm about to find you a lovely lady. She's Catalan. And I said, okay, Alison. And she said, she's going to come down to you on her break. And I said, you're serious? And she's like, yeah, yeah. And I said, for God's sake, Alison, I have to work with her. What am I supposed to do? And she said, talk to her. And Alba came down. And I actually blew it, to be honest with you. I was so nervous. I was shaking like a leaf pouring her tea, and I walked away because I couldn't face it. But she started messaging me on Facebook, and I thought she was being nice to me, and I thought, Jesus, isn't she lovely? And then eventually, in typical kind of Mediterranean passion, she said, oh my God, you idiot, can you not see I'm flirting with you? Do you not want to go on a date or what? And we did, and then we've been inseparable ever since. Can I just say one thing? Alba is very important to me, and if it wasn't for Alba, this book wouldn't exist. None of the stuff that has happened would exist, because she pushed me to reach my potential. Like, she told me to follow my passion. I was afraid to like, there's nothing wrong with working in a bar, but it wasn't for me, and I knew that I needed to be in nature, but I was too afraid to make that jump. And she said, Sean, get out there and do it, and I've got your back, you know, I'll support you until you get there. So it's because of Alba that I'm sitting in front of you now, and all of this stuff has happened.
Yeah, so another huge stroke of luck in who you came up against.
Absolutely.
In life. And I know she also kind of had to force you to open up a bit emotionally. She kind of helped you with eye contact, which was something you struggled with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was actually Alba who first suspected that you possibly had autism. Yeah.
Yeah, so Alba went back to train as a teacher. So one of the things that she specialised in for her dissertation was autism, and they had a specialist come in to give a talk, and he was listing off the traits of autism. So like, I have what would have been called Asperger's in the past, but it's all lumped now as ASD, Asperger's disorder. And she came back to me, and she basically said, Sean, I think you're autistic. I nearly spat my coffee out, and I said, what? And she said, yeah, we had someone in today, and they were describing the traits, and it sounded like he was literally describing you as a person. And I said, go on. And she started going through them, and she's like, you know, people on the spectrum typically have problems maintaining eye contact. They have really strict routines that they get really upset about if they're broken. They have really deep obsessions with distinct topics, often categorizing things, such as bird sound, for example. They have really strong sensitivities to touch and hearing, which again is, you know, it's me. You know, there's so many things, and it all registered, and I thought, oh my God. And I took an online test to start out, and sure, I passed it with flying colours. And then I went to the Asperger Society of Catalonia, and it was a very rigorous testing system. They were brilliant, and sure, I passed that with flying colours as well, and that was it. You know,
what does that do for you then to get the diagnosis? Yeah, they'll tell you. Yeah. Help you understand yourself?
Yeah, I mean, look, I didn't catch autism. Do you know, yeah. I was honestly born with it, and it's something that's always been there, and nothing has changed. But what has changed is it gave me an understanding of who I am and what drives me, and what drives the kind of little quirks that make, you know, maybe socializing a little bit different or make me seem like an oddball sometimes to people. And understanding that allowed me to, I guess, forgive myself in certain cases, you know, like, yeah, I wasn't the, you know, that weird guy that I thought I was. You know, there's a reason I had a problem maybe fitting in with big groups, because I didn't understand the group dynamics, the inherent rules that most people have weren't there for me. You know, I have to learn these things mechanically. I have to study people. And knowing that, it was forgiving, you know, because I thought, like, you know, this is who you are. You're a little bit different, and it's okay. But it also allowed me to embrace the many positives that come with this, for me at least.
You say in the book, excuse me, that a lot of the traits that your autism has given you is what led you to the birds, really.
Yeah, that's true in a sense. But I also need people to know that, like, you know, this is also down to a real love and a passion for nature, and like, to, you know, to get to the point where you know all of these bird sounds, it takes a lot of practice and a lot of immersion in nature. But absolutely, the heightened senses really are very helpful in that. Like, my hearing is extremely sensitive, and I hear these intricate details in there. But I also, one of the other really good traits of Asperger's, if you want to call it that, is hyper focus. So when I find something that I love, that's my world. I've got tunnel vision. Nothing can stop me. And, you know, I can go up and start editing my sounds at, say, 5 p.m. and then it's 4 a.m. And I have Alba knocking on the door saying, Sean, what are you doing, you madman? Will you ever go to bed? Do you know, this is hyper-focus. I'm in that world. And this is something that doesn't leave me. So it allows me to go to the real depths of whatever it is that I'm passionate about.
And before we leave the autism, just a thing that's worth saying, I think. You, some people's reactions when you told them you had autism kind of weren't great, in a sense.
Yeah, and I absolutely never go out to offend anyone. And I often think that some of the reactions that we get are not intended as being offensive either. So this condition is something that's invisible, if you like. You know, it's not as visible as other conditions, and sometimes people, I guess, they want to try and relate to you, and they might say something like, oh sure, we're all a bit on the spectrum, we're all a little bit autistic, aren't we? And it's, you know, it's like saying to somebody, like, imagine you wake up in the morning and you have swollen ankles, you're not on the pregnancy spectrum, you know what I mean? So like, to be diagnosed with autism, you have many, many, many characteristics, and often these characteristics lead to a life that's quite challenging. So to say that we're all a little bit autistic, it kind of denounces your experience and kind of belittles it in a sense. And I know that people don't mean it in that way, but yeah, that's how it feels, because it feels like you always have to kind of explain yourself and fight for what it is that you have, and almost prove it to people, you know, and sometimes that can be a little bit upsetting, I suppose, if you will.
Yeah. You'll hear a lot of parents of autistic children, a phrase they hate is, oh, sure, they're all like that, or sure, yeah, my one's like that as well.
Yeah.
And look, people, you're right to say, I think people mean no harm.
No, they don't.
But actually, I think it's really good to let people know that as well.
Sometimes you don't, you wouldn't think about it, like, you know, and it's just a case of that. Like, it's a kind of a throwaway.
Yeah.
Comment, yeah.
So yourself and Alba took off travelling then, Thailand, Nepal, then moved to around Barcelona where Alba's from. I think, was it your experience of nature abroad kind of made you start thinking about Ireland and nature here and made you kind of sad about Ireland?
Do you know what? I've been very careful about how I word myself when I'm talking about Irish nature. And I know that there's a lot of kind of doomism going around and people don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear these negative things. And I think that now I need to be straight up, because when I have this platform now, I feel like I have an obligation to stand up for the thing that's given me so much all my life. But I need to find that balance. I'm not going to drown people out in the sorrows, but I think when I give talks, for example, I try to hit a balance between reality. You know, 63% of Ireland's birds are at risk of extinction. But in a global sense, it was just announced recently by the World Wildlife Fund that 73% of studied wildlife has disappeared since 1970. This is shocking. This is not going to get better unless we change our ways. And I need that message to be very clear to people. But at the same time then, so when I came home, you know, I had that in my mind. And after coming from the wilderness of the Pyrenees, coming to Ireland, where there are no meaningful wild spaces in Ireland.
None.
There are none, no. So even our national parks, you know, these places that are set aside to be those places, they're completely sick, you know, they're sickly places that need a lot of work. And so I think that part of my work now is to make this known to people and make people realise that we have so much work to do. These places have so much potential and it's not too late. But I also want people to know that there's still great beauty out there. And this is why I captured these bird sounds, to share this beauty with people and to share these wonderful messages with people. So I want to woo people into action. I don't want to sadden them or anger them, which I think you do need a little sprinkle of anger and sadness too. But my primary weapon is love and awe.
You feel it really deeply, do you?
I do. This is everything to me. This is my life and this is going to be my life mission. I know that. And I'm here for it. I'm invested in it. So,
and look again, just on little things, right? People, kind of, as we were saying about the autism, most people want to do the right thing, right?
Yeah.
You talk about the landscape of Ireland a bit in the book, and you talk about that patchwork of fields and all that kind of thing. And it is a very striking kind of image when you think of it. If you went up in a helicopter and looked down at Ireland, and how curated the whole thing is, maybe.
Yeah.
And say people with their gardens, you think we kind of have that obsession with curating tidy garden spaces, like, and that's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is something that I need to be very careful about how I word, because I absolutely don't want to be going out and telling people I'm right and you're wrong and this is how you should do things and what you're doing is wrong. But the fact of the matter is, the reason so many of our birds and so much of global wildlife is in the position it is because of the fact that humans have taken over the vast majority of the world's lands. You know, they've turned them into monocultures. For example, in Ireland, you look at Google Maps, you zoom in and it's a jigsaw. It's essentially a jigsaw pattern of intensively managed cow fields. Then look at the uplands. Our uplands are essentially grazed bald. They're encroached by non-native conifer crops, and I call it a crop because it's absolutely not a forest. There will be some birds in there, but in comparison to a healthy native deciduous woodland, it's just a fraction of what would be there. The gardens are the same. So we have this obsession with lawns, large open spaces with just grass, and I look at them and I see them as spaces that are stolen from nature that don't need to be there. I understand that, you know, people have kids and they might want to play football or there's whatever, you want to sit down. But in some cases, there are lawns that are just absolutely grotesque. And these, I think that these are quite common. Even the verges of roads are just mown down to nothing. Why? You know, I remember even when I was young, driving in the roads with my father, you'd be wiping the insects off. That's gone now. And look, what's going to happen when Lia's older? Am I going to tell her stories of what's disappeared in that time? This can't keep going and going and sliding, because what happens in the end? What happens when 73 goes to 80% or 90%? We'll go too. And like, I need people to understand that I do this out of a place of love. You know, I want to save what's worth saving. That this beautiful, wonderful entanglement of nature, you know, it provides us so much beauty, wonder and awe. But it also has just as much right to be there as we do. And we need it. We're all a part of it. Without it, it's all going to fall apart. So, yeah.
Okay. And I think it's interesting that I think some environmental people, the young, passionate ones, can almost consider humanity a disease on the planet. Mm. You're not saying that. You're saying that we both need each other.
I think that humans are a beautiful species. We're capable of beautiful, great things. We've got wonderful culture. And I think most people are great people with a good heart who want to do the right thing. I just think that, you know, we've lost our way. We've lost our connection with nature. And this is part, again, it's part of what I want to do. I want to rewild people's minds and, you know, bring the nature table back to the schools. Bring nature in as a subject in schools. Bring nature walks back. I remember we used to have those. And in schools recently, I've been talking and I didn't see a single nature table. And I asked a question, you know, expecting everyone to know what I was talking about. I said, does everyone know what the Dawn Chorus is? And I was met with blank faces. This shocked me. I really hope that I can just help make a difference and rewild people's minds. And as I'm saying, people want to do the right thing. So it's about getting everyone on board and making them realise what beautiful nature there is in Ireland that we can help bring back and expand and make our wild spaces a great place to go out and visit and just get lost in.
How is your mission to record every Irish bird going? Are you nearly there?
Oh, yeah. So I've 199 species recorded now. I've got three more. The three that I had...
I presume these are the three difficult ones left
for last. They're still outstanding, and that's a job for... It's just been so crazy this year with everything going on with the film and everything, and I'm doing a lot of talks now. But next year, so there's grey partridge, that's a given, that's in one spot. Red-breasted merganser, it's a sea-going duck. And the last one, it's probably the last one for a reason, great skua. Great skua is a kleptoparasite. They look like a chocolate brown gull. And so... what they do is they don't feed for themselves. They're a seabird. They wait for other gulls to catch fish. They chase them down and they attack them and steal the fish off them. They're like pirates, winged pirates. And if they swallow the fish, they'll attack them until they regurgitate it. But they breed on offshore islands. And if you go out there, they'll attack you too. So I think I just need to build up some courage to get out for that one.
Okay. I think I'm starting to see by your body language that you want to get out of here now. Do you a bit like kind of?
I know.
Is a half hour sitting here?
No. Go
yeah,
for it.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely well, look. Not. Yeah. No. Look. I think you've said it all. And you know what? I would rarely sit back here and listen for 10 minutes while somebody just talked and talked about nature. But you're so compelling. It is lucky to. Have you, Sean? You're a fantastic advocate for it.
Yeah. I'm lucky that I have this stage. I'm lucky. I'm privileged that I can stand up and speak for the thing that I love so much, honestly.
Yeah. I stopped the other day. There's a place I go for a cup of coffee and a bun now and again, and there's always starlings around if you sit outside. And you regard them as a pest, you know, because they're around annoying people and they come right up and everything. And I stopped and looked and listened to one. And geez, it was a whole symphony. Like, it was all going on there. Like, you just stop and listen. Like,
have you ever heard a starling speak in a Cork accent?
No.
I have.
Yeah, really?
I had one that used to, because they're mimics, and there was one lived on my roof and it learned to mimic me calling my dog in. It used to say, come here.
Okay. The book is called Nature Boy. It's published by Hachette and... Sean, you're on Instagram, Irish Wildlife Sounds, and the album Hope, you'll be putting that up on Bandcamp for free in the next few days.
It'll be linked up on the Instagram anyway.
Okay, Sean Ronayne, thank you very much and the best of luck to you and Alba in this exciting time ahead.